Paper 33, section 7, which is old single column, page 372. Okay, so they wrap up this little overview of the administration of the local universe with, you know, what, you know, as you, when you get done with them, you see it's actually pretty brief, even though it's two sections. They're not revealing a lot, but it gives us at least a little bit more about what they touched on in the previous section, as we saw last time, and they sort of, in between the lines, referred to the fact that the three branches of government are spread across the three levels in the local universe. That at the local universe capital level, you have the judicial branch, you know, seated. At the constellation level in the middle, you have the seat of the legislative branch. And then the real spearhead of the executive branch is down at the local system level. So they're going to go through that a little bit more. And it occurred to me, just, you know, I could read and remind you of that very important little statement that they make up in, let's see, what is it, up in paper 71. You don't have to turn it if you want, but it's at the beginning of the last section of paper 71, section 8. It's on 806 in the single column. You know, they're in the midst of, in that paper, of talking about issues of government, development of the state, is the paper. And they give us a very, you know, interesting little reminder about the kind of government that we saw finally evolve into full establishment in this country, you know, and still really only definitively existing, you know, in a significant form in this country, even after all these years, that, you know, the three branches of government being really separated and expressed in a definitive fashion. And it's just interesting the way they point to that. You know, they're saying when you think about all the different ways you can set up human governments, in the midst of all that, they say the only sacred feature of any human government is the division of statehood into the three domains of executive, legislative, and judicial functions. The universe is administered in accordance with such a plan of segregation of functions and authority. You know, and that's just exactly what we're going to read about. That last comment, and just, you know, for them to say sacred, to use, you know, that strong a word and that, you know, that spiritual of a word. You know, to not say cosmic, say, but to actually say sacred. You know, they're reminding you that you have inherent in that separation into three branches something that's very, very definitively divine. That is very fundamental to the whole structure of reality, and is the spear point of heaven coming down to earth in many ways. That very fundamental aspect of the cosmos, you know, is from the very beginning is being efforted downward by those on high and those here who are trying to receive that which is coming down from on high, you know, the planetary government. That they're working from the earliest days to evolve that into existence, to get that pattern on high expressed down below. And we obviously don't even remotely appreciate the significance of it, you know, if it's worthy of the word sacred even being used there. So just to reflect upon, kind of humbly remind yourself that there's nothing coincidental And there's something deeply profound about that finally coming into expression on this planet. When we formed the United States of America, that was the culmination of a million years of effort to finally get that definitively expressed. And so when you think about how this is so much more than a text that attempts to strengthen our relationship to religion, that it's a full-on philosophic text. I mean, here's a simple example of what we're going to start reading tonight. It's obviously not a religious text when you just glance at the section titles, the courts of Nebadon and the legislative and executive functions. They're trying to get you to bring a much broader consciousness to bear on this thing than just what your initial religious desire is looking for. It wants you to spend some time reflecting on details of three branch government and why and noticing some of the details of how it's set up on high, and what that might say about where humans should be attempting to slowly evolve their expression of the pattern on high over time as we become more and more enlightened, more and more capable of expressing that which is on high. Obviously, if it wasn't so sad to record, we could take on advancing the expression of the patterns on high here below. But at the very least, we need to recognize what we must strive very vigorously to not lose. In the sense of Abraham Lincoln, ending the Gettysburg Address. If they're lost, the light really goes out on the planet, and it'll be very, very difficult to get it going again. This is a simple example. This level of government that reflects the government on high can't perish from the earth. If we want to have any chance of having an advancing civilization, sometime before a million years from now. Like I said, took a million years to get there. If things really unravel, it could take a very long time to put that back together again. Because we see that, we put it definitively out there when we formed the United States, and it's not like everyone on the planet said, oh my goodness, now that I see this, it's so clear, let's just throw out our primitive form of government and adopt that and rise to the challenge that demands of us. No.
And doesn't it say somewhere that that's a stage in the ultimate government that we're going to be evolving into? This is not the end point, but a stage.
Yeah, I mean, everything.
Every branch of government is a stage.
Yeah, everything, of course, is, in some degree a stage. But, the three branches, in a sense, is an end in itself. I mean, to have three. No amount of evolution in the universe of universes evolves away the three branches of government. They stand, exactly how they're expressed, and how they function. Sure, that evolves. But the fact that there's three and that they're separate stands. You never blur the legislative into the judicial. When a local universe is settled in light and life, even. Okay, so it's a very important part of having a cosmic form in an evolutionary domain.
The one thing that I've noticed that we have as humans that I haven't noticed anything in the Urantia book is we have the two-party system. But I highly doubt there's a two-party system out there.
Well, remember, even our founding fathers attempted to not have a two-party system. But see, that's to get beyond a two-party system, or beyond very immediate tendencies to express things in dichotomies. That requires some evolution. I mean, it was really hyper-idealistic for the founding fathers to think that they could somehow institute by fiat, something that's above left and right at this stage of human evolution. It's not there. Eventually, we will be upists and not leftists and rightists. You know, eventually, we will strive for a quality of thinking that it would just innately transcend that tendency to think in dichotomies. Especially the very stark dichotomies that get, hyper zealized, by the sixth adjutant.
Well, and they cause so much division and separation that it almost feels Luciferian, like the manifesto.
Let me just comment on that, and then we'll get going here. But just be careful about the tendency to use your ability to see ideals way far in the future now and judge things now relative to that. Now is a divine dispensation. The fact that it was attempted to eliminate that two-party system, but it immediately evolved right back into place. Whose evolution is that? That's God's evolution. It's part of the Father's way right now. It's not evil. We don't have that because of the Lucifer rebellion or because of the default. It's part of evolution, just like so many very difficult expressions of tension are a part of evolution. You have to go through those phases. Slavery, war, social classes, and profit motive, are stronger tensions than a two-party system. And those are indispensable to a progressing, early progressing civilization. And that indispensability reflects the fact that that's the Father's way. War, for instance, is the Father's way of getting to light and life. Not because he arbitrarily chose that amongst many options. I mean, if it's the Father's way, it's the only way. The only way to get animal origin creatures to light and life is through war, is through slavery, is through, et cetera. All these things are indispensable to that process. They're part of the Father's finger snap spread out over time. It's just the way the system has to be. So judge it, when you bring in those high ideals, pull yourself out of time. Don't drag those high ideals down into time. They have no relationship to some point in time. They only can be overlaid on temporal affairs in a very eternalized, very long-term perspective. Okay. Otherwise, it'll get you all confused about what's going on. All right. Okay, so let's jump into it. So, what about, you see they're going to just kind of go top down. They'll do the judicial, and then they have a legislative executive in that order in the next section title. So they're going to take you top down, basically, through the system and make, give us a few little details about how this works. All right.
7. The courts of Nebadon. The master son, Michael, is supremely concerned with but 3 things: creation, sustenance, and ministry. He does not personally participate in the judicial work of the universe. Creators never sit in judgment on their creatures. That is the exclusive function of creatures of high training and actual creature experience.
Okay. And you notice that immediately you see how peers are part of the process. They mention that right away in the first paragraph. That is the exclusive function of creatures of high training, and actual creature experience, yes, but creatures nonetheless. And remember when we went through some of the Trinity origin and Trinity achieved beings in previous papers, they talked about the whole justice administration aspects of beings that are closely associated with the Trinity when they're talking about the tribunals in the, at the super universe level. But here we're dropping down into the local universe level with the tribunals. All right, so he Michael, or you know, any creator son or master son, do not personally participate in the judicial work of the universe. So yes, there's, you know, like especially the master son, he's literally full on sovereign, but he does not participate in the judicial. So there's an example right there of how things are separated. He's not meddling, you know, like some king might say, into those judicial affairs. They're very separate. And, you know, when they say creators never sit in judgment on their creatures, it's like, well, what about the capital J judges? Those are creators. You know, see, so kind of, you know, read between the lines there. The creatures that those creators, the Ancients of Days, create, don't ever have to be judged. Okay, they're innately integrous. Okay, so it's only when you drop down to the lowest level of creators, the Creator Son, Creator Mother Spirit, that you have creatures that you know, may stand in need of judgment of some sort. May not be, you know, eternal judgment, but judgment of some sort. And so, you know, that's why you've got very close at hand another creator who didn't literally, you know, create, say, Lenonidex, that can be the judge in the Ancients of Days.
20 Hail Marys.
Or whatever it takes, yes. Remember that one time they kind of point out that you sort of have all those that are waiting for the Lucifer Rebellion to be adjudicated. They're kind of on long-term KP duty right now. The ones that, you know, that really repented, you know, but they haven't been restored to some, you know, normal state of affairs. So they're in this holding pattern right now. Yep.
Excuse me, but yep. I did find where I was looking for it, that you can clarify that for me.
Okay.
It says, while there is a divine, while there is a divine and ideal form of government, such cannot be revealed.
Right. I mean, because.
And I just, that's where
okay. Now, yeah. And that's because those, you know, we will evolve into an ideal form of government, and you know, as we get into light and life, and that has to evolve.
By my curiosity, yeah. I thought it was a
but the thing you know, you do know one thing about that future government: it will have three branches.
Yeah.
Even though you don't know any of the details necessarily, you do know that basic foundational fact. Okay. Because, you know, even though a planet is deeply settled in light and life, I mean, beings way up in the chain still need the judicial system. You know, so just because you're in light and life doesn't mean you're suddenly in a Havona-like state, you know, where everything is just automatically coordinated. No, you still need all kinds of judicial action to coordinate things, because there isn't innate perfection, so that it just is coordinated. All right. Yeah, so that's another thing. You know, don't just think of judicial action as being some, you know, heavy-handed, you know, thumbs up, thumbs down thing. It isn't all, you know, the eternal, you know, issue in play. All right. Let's see. What else is there? So keep in mind, we'll see it, they're going to come back to this in a minute here. So he's concerned with but three things: creation, sustenance, and ministry. You know, and sustenance in the same sense that you talk about the Father as creating and maintaining. Okay. They mentioned that. You'll notice a little contrast as we get a little deeper on that. Anything else there? No, let's get some more here.
The entire judicial mechanism of Nebadon is under the supervision of Gabriel. The high courts, located on Salvington, are occupied with problems of general universe import and with the appellate courts appellate court, appellate cases yeah. coming up from the system tribunals. There are 70 branches of these universe courts, and they function in 7 divisions of 10 sections each. In all matters of adjudication, there presides a dual magistracy consisting of one judge of perfection antecedents and one magistrate of ascendant experience.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that last part, you know, we've seen that before. So they have the perfect perfected sort of pairing going on again. You notice, so it's not really telling you much about who this is and stuff. It's all very vague on the details of who exactly is involved with this. It probably involves a lot of unrevealed beings, you know, in some of these areas. But nonetheless, you know, they are telling you it has that. It has a. There is a dual magistracy. Magistracy. There we go. It's a hard word to say. There's two different flavors of magistrates. The perfect perfected. Okay, and then the other thing you have in there is the 70. Okay, so again, remember what that's telling you. When you see the number 70 cropping up, they're telling you that you have the full associativity being expressed, because you have a sevenfold individuation of spirit unity, you know, that is you know, at the ceiling of this whole universe of universes, with, you know, literally expressed as 7 super universes. But that sevenfoldness is within each super universe as well. You have 7 reflective mother spirits, you know, it's because of that. So you have all 7 modes of unity being expressed in the super universe, and you have the tenfold individuality, you know, that's ubiquitous, universal maybe I should say, you know, that's universal. So you have 70 different associative modes. And so there's 70 different types of courts, as it were, each tailored to those 70 different modes of associativity. 70 different ways that individuality can relate to unity. You know, so 70 different, you know, and that's like we were just saying a minute ago, a lot of what you're adjudicating here is the association of beings is not automatic when you're not Havona natives, say. Everything isn't just perfect and pre-coordinated. So you need someone to help out with all of these complexities of association. And there's 70 different flavors of association, see? Yeah.
Where does the 10 individuality divisions come from, originate from?
I mean, all this originates in the pattern universe. The tenfoldness comes from the pattern universe. The sevenfoldness comes from the pattern universe. It's just, you know, I don't want to get into all that, but, you know, we all know that it's not a coincidence that we have 10 fingers, for instance. There's a fundamental tenfoldness that's ingrained in individuality expression. You have 10 different types of physical energy. You know, on and on like this. There's a lot of complexity to that, a lot of different ways it's expressed, but independent of the details of the expression, like, you know, exactly how those 10 phases of energy might differ or something, overarching all the specific expressions of tenfoldness, there's this fundamental philosophic fact in the universe of universes, that individuality is tenfold, unity is sevenfold. And those two are always being juxtaposed. Okay? Sometimes, you know, the foundational tenfoldness gets multiplied, so there's 100 elements, say. You know, it becomes 10 times 10. But it's always rooted in 10. Yeah. You know, there's not 49 elements, you know, 7 times 7. That sort of thing.
All the architectural spheres are in multiples of 7.
Right. You see the 70, you know, in all the in the structures and the architectural spheres. That's because of the 70-fold associativity. You know, and it'll be different ways. Is it which is primary? You know, in the setup, the 7 or the 10, and that'll indicate whether or not it's broken into 10 groups of 7 or 7 groups of 10. See, things like this. Now you notice here, they said there's 7 divisions of 10 sections each. So the 7 is the primary. Okay, we're at the unity level in the local universe. The local universe headquarters is the unity level. See, so there you, and this judicial. So the unity is the dominant pattern with the tenfold within each 7. Okay, so just kind of what you might logically expect.
Was 70 the size of the smaller group that met at Sadler's house back in the day? Does that
happen? Well, there, you know, 70 crops up, you know, like the, you know, and you're reading through the Jesus papers, you have this, you know, the 70 evangelists, and, you know, then it's called the Septuagint. The Greek translation of the Hebrew Old Testament because of the, you know, those 70 scholars. And 70 crops up a lot. And the fact that it's now been revealed that it's a pattern on high, you know, gets you suspicious. It's like, so coincidentally, you know, a full measure of associativity coalesced there. There were 70 individuals, you know, spanned across the whole space of associative character. You got to wonder, see, about the hand of the Supreme in some of these, you know, 70s coming into existence now. Now that you know it's not, you know, it's like 1,000, you know. It's, you know, you might think from history that 1,000 is, you know, millennium, was just kind of, you know, numerology. People, you know, liked the number, and so they rationalized everything as happening, you know, in millennia, you know, but then the Revelation says, well, you gotta be careful. That may actually be a shadow cast from on high, because there's nothing more fundamental chronologically in the universe of universes than 1,000 years. You know, and it is a coincidence that a 1,000 of our years is very close, almost exactly, you know, how long it takes the inner circuit of Avona to go around. So, yeah, there's a whole bunch of things like this that they're trying to get you to be a little less dismissive of. It's like, maybe that 70 or that 1,000 or that, you know, that whatever isn't just coincidental.
That says about that 70 times 7 imperative. You're off the hook at 71. You've exhausted it, you're done.
But, yeah, but anyway, here it is again. So, you know, even though we don't get any explanation of exactly, you know, what the difference in flavor of those 70 courts is, you know, that you just philosophically, you know, that's why there is. You know, so they've got it very, it's very precise. In other words, this adjudication that's going on is very precise. You have it tailored, you know, to very specific issues, so that you have experts in that particular aspect of association in the cosmos. You know, just like you kind of see when you see government on a neighboring planet, you know, you see a little bit greater specificity of their, in their courts. You know, we have a little bit of that, you know, evolving in place here. You know, it's basically encouraging you to do that more. You know, don't think so one size fits all about your court system. Think about tailoring it a little bit more. This particular aspect of society should have its own little, you know, niche in the court system. So that's a lesson they're teaching us here. Let's see. Yes, let me just check, make sure. Is there anything else? Oh, yeah, there was one other thing. Lose here. So just notice Gabriel. They mentioned Gabriel. Remember, they talked about him earlier in the paper here. So he's chief executive, yes. But since the judicial element is seated at the local universe headquarters level, That's certainly where Gabriel has his home base. The entire judicial mechanism of Nebadon is under the supervision of Gabriel. So it gives you kind of a little twist on a lot of what he is doing as chief executive isn't sort of immediately the executive branch, but being, you know, in charge of that level of the three branches of government. He's chief executive, you know, executive in a more direct sense, in that if there's executive things happening at the local system level that need to be appealed up, you know, he's the final executive authority. He's the supreme executive authority. So, you know, so things at a local system level could get appealed up to him, and he would function very literally as a chief executive. But, you know, barring that, kind of what's more at eye level is this judicial things rather than the executive things. Yeah, so that's another thing that you might, you know, not be immediately thinking when you see him called chief executive. All right.
As regards jurisdiction, the local universe courts are limited in the following matters. One, the administration of the local universe is concerned with creation, evolution, maintenance, and ministry. The universe tribunals are, therefore, denied the right to pass upon those cases involving the question of eternal life and death. There is no reference to natural death as it obtains on your rancho.
This has no.
But if the question of the right of continued existence, life eternal, comes up for adjudication, it must be referred to the tribunals of Orvantan. And if decided adversely to the individual, all sentences of extinction are carried out upon the orders and through the agencies of the rulers of the supergovernment.
Okay. All right, so notice how they start out. So the administration of the local universe is concerned with creation, evolution, maintenance, and ministry. So like I said, they're going to come back, but notice how they added a word, and they modified another one of the words. Before, we said the master's son was concerned with but three things: creation, sustenance, and ministry. And now we have creation, evolution, maintenance, and ministry. Okay, so evolution is the main thing that's been added there. The master son, you know, or even really so much, you know, even the creator son, is not directly involved with evolution. God the mother evolves things. See, so that's the creative mother spirit's domain pretty definitively out of those four in the local universe. The evolution is being handled very definitively by the mother, as it always is everywhere. God the Mother evolves the universe of universes. And then they use the more general term of maintenance in contrast to sustenance. They're kind of synonyms, but maintenance is basically more general. And because here you want, I mean, one of the ways that the Creative Mother Spirit is maintaining the local universe, she's the upholder. That maintains. So she falls under the maintenance as the upholder, the local universe upholder. Okay, and then a kind of a more specific type of maintenance, sustenance, that the creator son or the master son provides is not that literal upholding type of maintenance. For instance, the spiritual strength that beings get when the spirit of truth is poured out. You know, that's a maintenance or a sustenance, more specifically. You know, that's strengthening. And then also the whole issue of the Creator Son being in charge of restoring worlds or systems if there's rebellion or default, you know, and bringing them back. You know, that sustaining of keeping things going in spite of those difficulties. So those specific areas of maintenance that you could call sustenance, that's what he's involved in. Yeah, but the big glaring one is obviously evolution. Yeah. The Creator Son is not really the agent. Even the Master Son is not an agent of evolution. The Creator Mother Spirit is. Yep.
Would it be proper to think of Jesus or Christ as a redeemer in this sense, in a personal sense?
Yeah. Like they say way up in, when they first start talking about the Eternal Son and bestowal sons, they point out that very significant element that those sons that come from the Eternal Son are, one of their primary roles is to retrieve the lost sheep. Yeah, that's the truth of that Christian concept of a redeemer. Yeah. Let's see. Okay. All right. So, notice what they do right up front. Okay. So they're gonna. They don't tell you any specifics about what these courts, quote unquote, courts in Abaddon do. They tell you what they don't do. They got three bullet points here. They're going to tell you what they don't do. And the first thing they don't do is they don't do the capital J judges. The whole eternal question is in play with an individual. Have they gone to iniquity and are no longer personal and their energy system needs to be dispersed by the divine executioners? That personal judgment issue, again, like they reminded you in the first paragraph, is not, being handled by the local universe tribunals. That's being handled by the super universe tribunals, and above it all, the Ancients of Days. Okay, but notice what they threw in. They obviously are up against some revelatory limitations here about what they can say. So they're trying to kind of sneak things in subtly. Look at what they said. So they said, the universe tribunals are, therefore, denied the right to pass upon those cases involving the question of eternal life and death. This has no reference to natural death as it obtains on Urantia. But if the... Why did they throw in that? Okay. Obviously... what they're trying to remind you of there, a local universe tribunal could hand down a judgment that involved death of mortals. They might rule that an individual or a group of individuals, a whole race maybe, needs to be expedited to the happy hunting grounds. for the greater good. Okay? You're reminded of this occasionally between the lines. And there's race commissioners, for instance, that we'll read about, in a few papers. And angels of various types that are involved with race. Where they're advocating for a race. It's like, well, why do you need these, really, all these different flavors and these definitive advocates for a race? It's like, well, because sometimes... there may be those on higher saying, I think it would be a lot easier to sort out things on this world if we just kind of nudged that race out of existence. And maybe not so nudging. Yeah, maybe a little more definitively. They mention that those sorts of issues when they're talking about the universal conciliators and the strange doings of them sometimes on a world. Okay. All that's between the lines, and here it is again. Sometimes there may be natural, physical death might be handed down, just like human courts will hand down a death sentence. No human court can hand down an eternal death sentence, and no local universe court is allowed to either. Just think about that fact, that the death penalty, is basically, in some ways, a downstepped expression of a pattern on high. Yeah. So no wonder, you know, it just, I mean, yeah, I mean, there's obviously buts to this, you know. I mean, we have all kinds of problems, but just, you know, as a most general thing, just notice, it's not as simple. You know, that's why Jesus said to the condemned criminal, we don't have any place to overrule, you know, the death sentence that's been given to you. That's just in the eyes of the universe. You know, but there's that ministry thing, you know, it's, you know, ministry occurs in the face of, I mean, if someone on a world is handed a death sentence, like a whole race, you'd be guaranteed there'll be lots of ministry to those as they are nudged off the stage. But they're still going to be nudged off the stage. Just like Jesus ministered to the condemned criminal, but didn't stop his death sentence. Yeah, John, go ahead.
Yeah, I just don't want the people listening in to think that that's happening all the time just because it could happen. And, you know, the things that you think about that you think that would happen, it didn't necessarily. I think the allowance of, you know, people to express their free will and go forward, you know, it's like why they didn't adjudicate the Lucifer Rebellion right away.
Right.
They said, let it go. Matter of fact, advertise it. Get people, if they're going to go bad, so to speak, then let them go, because we want to know now. Or we want that to happen. So, I mean, I'm not so sure that, you know, that I really believe that, that what they're saying here is that, you know, they're judges on high. They're sitting here saying, okay, Chris, you know,
you know, I'm pretty sure that's a done deal.
You can survive life after death, but, you know,
I got the memo.
Drink the hemlock now and you're out of here.
Right. I mean, you know that it's not going to be minutiae issues.
Get rid of Caiaphas.
Okay. I mean, there. It's not like you've got, you know, these local universe courts doing what human courts doing, you know, picking out a particular individual because he's inconvenient and stuff like this. But the spectrum is, I mean, regarding what you're saying, you can speculate that this may not happen a lot, maybe even in all of our local universe, because of the kind of creator son we have, that he's so mercy dominated. But see, like we've talked about before, you gotta wonder, you know, in another local universe where things are run much more tightly, and they don't let things kind of just play out in the hand of the mother over millions of years, you know, they run it a little bit tighter. Maybe local universe tribunals in those local universes do a lot more micromanagement. See, you can speculate along those lines. And that's kind of one of the things that's important about this. I mean, we can't help but sort of be immersed in the mentality of our Michael. And to think of the way he runs things as being the way to run things. You know, the revelation is trying to get us to not be so limited like that. I mean, there's a limit to how much we can really sort of believe, like kind of like you're saying, that a local universe could actually be run by that. It'll just seem so foreign to us because we're immersed in a mind energy that is subservient to the will of our Creator Son. The way we think, the way we perceive things is dictated by how he runs the ship here. Not to mention, you know, when we reflect on history like you were just doing there, I mean, it's obvious that there's all kinds of horrendous things that are allowed to just happen and play out over time. You know, we don't seem to have much experience with a tightly run ship when we look back in history. I mean, that's why it's important for the Revelation to occasionally point out when that does inject in, you know, that the Most High Observer, maybe in a regency mode, I don't know, but at least the Most High Observer, you know, delivered all those armies into Abraham's hands. Okay, someone decided that all those people needed to die, and Abraham was given the job of killing them, you know, rather than the divine executioner. See, so that was a decision like this. Someone decided that all those thousands of people were going to die, and Machaventa, you know, testified to it. Your enemies have been delivered into your hands by the Most High. So there's an example, see, of someone being taken off the playing field because of a ruling that was, you know, that came down from somewhere, and literally overruled Machaventa. Machaventa didn't want that to happen. He thought it wasn't wise. Someone with more wisdom overruled him and said, no, the wiser thing is that those most of those armies are slaughtered. So, you know, but we don't get the sense that it happens a lot. Most of the time it seems like those are aggrandized stories, and apparently they are, you know, when we have stories of that.
The bigger issue here is that even if that were to happen to you,
mm-hmm.
that has nothing to do with your overall judgment.
Of course not.
I think that's the big issue here, yeah. You know, what they're talking about, that you know, even if these things do happen, you know,
even though he slay me, yeah.
they can't, they're not right. dissolving you from.
Yeah, right. Good point. I mean, that's, you know, that's the, another thing that's, you know, that comes out of the fact that they mention both mortal death and eternal death right. here to get those straight. Because humans cannot keep them straight. You know, the moment that anyone talks about the death penalty on this planet, everyone is thinking eternal. About it. It's like, well, you're playing God. No, you're not playing God. You can't play God, okay? You know, and interestingly, even the first God up in the hierarchy can't even play God like that. Not even Michael and the Creative Mother Spirit can play God like that. You know, rule on eternal issues, okay? But, you know, if humans aggrandize themselves, you know, in thinking that they're somehow deciding the eternal destiny of an individual by executing them, I mean, we're so wrapped around the axle, we're never going to get anywhere. We got to think more clearly. We got to separate the apples and the oranges, okay? That is a completely different issue. There's nothing that anyone can do to affect the soul of another individual. Only that person's free will can do anything to their soul. Not even God can do anything to a soul. Not the Universal Father, not anyone can affect the soul of an individual. The Ancients of Days can't do anything to the soul of an individual. They're just figuring out with the universal sensors, the great big microscopes, okay, if there's no soul left. Okay, if there's no soul, then they can discard with the body. But they, not even the capital J judges can do anything with a soul. You know, you have absolute free will. You overrule the capital J judges with your soul. As long as you're choosing to have a soul, you're part of the universe, and no one, you know, can stop that.
Only you can.
No matter how horrendous your disfigured soul is. You can maraud with it until you don't have one.
Only you can turn it off.
Only you can turn it off. Okay? And that's that last thing that, you know, that they talk about. I mean, you may have completely evacuated your soul. It's utterly hollow, but it's still a vessel. The very last step before you're eliminated by the divine executioner, if you're a spirit being, you know, whatever, is when you actually eliminate the vessel. You've evacuated it, but there's still a vessel. There's still a heart. That last step that you take with your, the last thing you do with your personality, if you're going to iniquity, is to evaporate the vessel. You've already evacuated the contents. That last step is to take away the temple. You know, you dissolve the temple. Yeah, and then the Ancients of Days say there's no temple anymore. Executioner, wipe them out. But yes, it's, you know, separate these things. You know, and to recognize that, you know, like they tell you, if you're doing your best and you decide what's best for the greater good, you know, that this person, this criminal, needs to be executed. That which you decide on earth is honored in heaven. Don't get yourself all balled up, you know, thinking that you're making some eternal decision for this individual. That's impossible. Okay, you're making a simple practical decision for the greater good of mankind, you know, or your society or whatever. All right, so the local universe tribunals don't have anything to do with individual judgment, you know, relative to eternity. What else don't they deal with?
Two, the the default or defection of any of the local universe sons of God, which jeopardizes their status and authority as sons, is never adjudicated in the tribunals of a son. Such a misunderstanding would be immediately carried to the super universe courts.
Okay, so another issue. Again, as you can see, it's related to what they said in the very first paragraph, that the creator of those sons is not, you know, not even his local universe tribunals, even though he's not directly involved in them, you know, are not going to be involved in that. That's got to go up to the super universe tribunals again. Notice the qualifier. If the default or defection, you know, quote unquote, is jeopardizes their status and authority as sons. Okay. I mean, the local universe tribunals are going to adjudicate all the minor issues that go on. The system sovereign, he's completely integrous. There's nothing rebellion or even default anything going on. But the system sovereign doesn't agree with the Most Highs about something. You know, the local universe tribunals adjudicate that, you know, and say, actually, we're going to overrule the Most High, say, and you know, the system sovereign is going to, you know, is going to take the lead on this, or whatever decision is made. Those minor issues, because they aren't perfect beings, even the Most Highs, even though they can never rebel, they have little blind spots of wisdom, you know, just like the Melchizedeks have little blind spots of wisdom. And so it can go both ways. You know, a Verondadek might see things more wisely than a Melchizedek in a certain little area, like apparently was the case with Abraham and the armies we were just talking about, or it could be the other way around. A Melchizedek might see things a little more wisely, you know, in an area. Now, one of the ways that the Verondadeks overcome their individual deficits is they work in a trio.
Oh, yeah.
You know, there's three Most Highs. And there is a Most High, but, you know, it's really three individuals. And so between the three of them, you know, it's going to be pretty rock solid. You know, if they're working coordinated, it's not too likely they're going to have a common blind spot in wisdom amongst the three of them. So it's going to be pretty integrous at the, you know, with the constellation. Yeah.
You talked a little bit about what Jesus did on Mount Hermon concerning his battle with the...
For those on the webinar, she's bringing up Mount Hermon with Jesus and confronting the rebels. You notice that if you go back and read that, Michael asked permission to engage him as Jesus, not as Michael. See, which fits into this. He really shouldn't be engaging them as Michael, and he didn't. But he can engage him as Jesus, as a first circler. He can engage them, and he did. Talk about the high and mighty being laid low. You know, a lowly, first circler, but still a lowly mortal. You know, just, you know, ran circles around them. You know, so who's so smart now?
Embarrassing.
Yeah, right. You know, that's a real. You know, a lot of people in the universe, you know, saw clearly that. Even as a first circler, Jesus didn't have anywhere near as vast a mind as Lucifer, say. But it's not how brilliant you are. It's how ignorant you aren't. Yeah. And Jesus was not ignorant. Those rebels are.
I wasn't thinking about that. I was thinking about he said, I can hardly judge you. I am your creative father.
Right, right.
I turn you over to a higher authority.
Right, right, right. Yeah. So
he was doing it both. He was engaging in both ways. Apparently, he was telling him, "I can't engage you."
Right. Yeah. See, he's just verifying what I'm saying here, and that, you know, but he could engage him as Jesus.
So he said, yeah. He just said that. Okay.
Right. He's just sort of, you know, telling you what is said right here. You know, in this section we're reading, that, you know, he has no place as the Creator's Son to be engaging, judging them. I mean, if he did, he'd be in rebellion. You know, he has to completely not touch that. Just like we just read here in item number two. Such a misunderstanding would be immediately carried to the Super Universe courts. Because if it's not immediately, someone's in rebellion. Someone is stepping into space that they're not allowed. If Michael didn't instantaneously pass that up, he would be in rebellion. You know, he can't even delay it for a half a second, because that would be him, you know, intervening in it, making a modification of the adjudication of it. 1 second delay is a ruling on the circumstance.
Shadow of a hair's turn.
Right. So you can't even touch it. Okay. Right.
Three. The question of the readmission of any constituent part of a local universe, such as a local system, to the fellowship of full spiritual status in the local creation subsequent to spiritual isolation must be concurred in by the High Assembly of the Super Universe.
Okay, so just, yeah, that's that point. Okay, so then, you know, that other little issue that obviously the local universe is very intimately involved in actually reestablishing the circuits and all this sort of stuff. I mean, the centers and controllers that are in the local universe are literally going to be doing that, and they're following the orders of the local universe. But, you know, it's not done just within the local universe. It has to be concurred in by the High Assembly of the Super Universe. Okay. So the Ancients of Days would give the go-ahead, and then all the details are handled down in the local universe. Okay. All right, so those are the three things. So as long as it doesn't involve, you know, circuits being cut off because of rebellions or the actual rebels or an individual choosing iniquity, everything else could be handled at the local universe and doesn't need to go up to the super universe. It's going to, the local universe ruling is going to be supreme, not appealable. And you see this a lot in this system. We saw it back when we did the Universal Conciliators. You know, remember in the midst of these sort of this fixed structure of tribunals that you have at super universe and local universe, you have the roving court of the Universal Conciliators, you know, the mobile court. And if the issue is appropriately handled by them, that's it. It can't be, their ruling can't be appealed. They're the last word. It doesn't matter if they're functioning down on a world, you know, inhabited world level. They're not even at the local system level, but actually functioning down on an individual realm. If they make a ruling, it can't be appealed. That's it. You know, it's the same way here. If it's the local universe's job to handle it, they're the last word, period. Can't be appealed up to the super universe. So it's like you have that absoluteness going all the way down. But, you know, so where the real kind of appealing happens is when someone doesn't have full authority to totally rule on something, you know, and it involves aspects that are higher. Like they mentioned with the Universal Conciliators, they might start looking at it, they get into it, it's like, oh, no, wait a minute, no, this, we can't, you know, if we were to rule, it would be the last word, but we don't have the authority to have the last word on this issue, so they shut it down and they hand it up. Okay, so that's how it's done up front, deciding who really, you know, has final authority on this, and then they take it all the way, whether, even if that's a low court, quote unquote. So it's a kind of a different kind of a hierarchy. See, there's a hierarchy, but it's not so much like ours where, you know, you can always appeal things up to the Supreme Court, say, you know, in general.
If you got enough money.
Yeah, if you got enough money, yeah. but see, here sometimes, no. You know, and an example where it all goes into a single individual, and it, you know, the people involved can't even appeal to, say, a roving commission, you know, of universal conciliators. If the Most High Observer assumes a Most High Regency, you know, a regency, then that one individual is it. His edicts are absolute, as if the absolute Father was giving them, and are not appealable. So it can come down, you know, down into the trenches with a single individual ruling very definitively, with no appeal possible. Okay, so she's shades of the absolute law are filtered in, you know, amongst all the relativity of the hierarchy. You don't ever forget that it's all, there's an absolute law behind this, and, you know, and it pokes out at times. And that's why you've heard me say, you got to be very careful asking for direct interface to absolute love, because you also have a direct interface to absolute law if you get absolute love. It's only relative love that where there's a separation between the love and the law. You go up to the absolute level and there's no separation. You get them at the same time. So, you know, to receive the fullness of absolute love is to be absolutely judged at the same time. So be careful what you ask for. Be ready to be absolutely judged. I want to put your house in order first. All right, let's see. Okay, so that deals with that. Okay, so let's get the last comments in here then.
In all other matters, the courts of Salvington are final and supreme. There is no appeal and no escape from their decisions and decrees.
Okay, I just, you know, stress, and look, it's just a single little paragraph there. I already said the first part, but look at what they threw in that last part. Not only is there no appeal, there's no escape. Very interesting expression.
Can't avoid it and can't do nothing.
You can run, but you can't hide.
You can't look at it from human terms
because they're using our
words. They're a lot better judging than we
are. Yeah, of course they are. But are you afraid of that sentence? This is a test. Jesus said, "Fear not." You know, Jesus said, "Fear not," and I'm purposely stressing this to try to invoke fear in the room. I want to see if you're afraid of these sentences. You've got to face the fact. If you feel a fear response, remember, this book is not for timid souls. Okay? It's for those who have already done what Jesus told us to do 2,000 years ago, where you fear not. If you have a shred of fear in you yet, this book will find it, and it'll fan it into a burning flame of fear. There's all kinds of things to invoke fear in this thing. If you're afraid, you know, if you don't have absolute confidence in your Heavenly Father's overcare, see, this book will find that weakness. It'll find your spiritual weak points. You need spiritual strength. It's testing you. It's a test. Can you read these things and not be afraid? Because you know you are perfecting. You're not perfect, but you don't have to be perfect. You're not supposed to be perfect. You're supposed to be perfecting. That's what goodness is. If you're good, no one's going to put a thumbs down on you. You can face these negative things and feel no fear.
Even if you want to be good. I mean, it's more and more in your intentions. You may not always be good
you won't see. That's more of a perfect imperfect.
Right.
Okay. If you're perfecting, you're always perfecting. See, don't look at it factually. Factually, you go, sometimes you're good, sometimes you're not. But see, that's not a proper judgment of yourself. That's an existential judgment of yourself, and so it's invalid. It has no meaning, no place. The trick is to stop judging yourself factually and start judging yourself truthfully. And it's the truths of eternity, so they don't change. There's no now and not now to truth. Okay? It has no relationship to time. The truth of you is not a function of time. It doesn't change from today to tomorrow. The facts of you change from today to tomorrow, but not the truth. Find the truth of yourself. If you find it, you'll find it's perfecting. And it's constantly, uniformly perfecting. Doesn't waver. That's the real you. That's the you that can trust God. That's the you that isn't afraid. The factual you, or the part of you that sees the factual you, that's the part that can be afraid of the facts. That's the whole test here. Find the truth of yourself. Stop judging yourself the way you've been told to judge yourself, the ignorant human way, the only thing that humans have ever known, ignorance. The revelation is here to change that. Stop judging yourself in that way. Judge yourself truthfully. Okay? Now, you're going to have to be satisfied with a smaller you when you do this, because the true you is a faint flicker. Everyone in this room, the true you is a very thin little faint flicker, okay? But it's rock solid. You can hang your hat on it. It's eternal in nature, okay? Don't worry about the fact that the 99.999% of you is this balled up gobbledygook, that is a roller coaster ride relative to existential goodness, okay? Don't worry about that anymore. Hang your hat on the real you. You got something on the web?
Yes, I do. William had a question.
Mm-hmm.
He said, in the administration of the local universe, does the executive branch appoint justices subject to legislative approval?
Let's get to the next section, and you'll see how that relates a little bit. However, I'll just make this one statement. We touched on that in the previous section, last session, when they talked about ambassadors and consuls and observers. Remember that when they were talking about those three different? And they talked about the ambassadors being appointed by judicial decree. The consuls were appointed by legislative decree and the observers by executive decree. So if you have things happening, I mean, obviously an ambassador isn't immediately related to judicial actions, okay? But appointing an ambassador is described as a judicial decree. So they're telling you that the way rulings are handed down on the three levels, even if it isn't immediately about, say, legislation or executive functions, they have that particular flavor to them, distinction between them. If Gabriel does an executive thing, he does it with a judicial flavor. Just like those ambassadors are appointed with a judicial mode of functioning. So, and it's like, well, what do you mean by that? Well, that's kind of the point. They're trying to get you to reflect on that. It's like, well, what exactly is that difference? They're trying to get you to reflect on the three branches and think about them, try to find the pattern of them rather than, it's like, well, all I know is the examples I've experienced on this planet. It's like, well, it's going to be very shadowy and faint there. Try to see if you can penetrate through that limited, expression. See if you can get a sense of what is the real difference between judicial, legislative, and executive. I mean, exactly how is the different way that they're appointing these ambassadors? Exactly how is that different? Okay. I don't have an immediate answer to that. They're challenging me to start reflecting on that too. Try to see if I can get a better sense of the truth of the three branches, the truth of the difference of those three modes of functioning. Okay, so then the last part here.
However unfairly human contentions may sometime appear to be adjudicated on Urantia, in the universe justice and divine equity do prevail. You are living in a well-ordered universe, and sooner or later you may depend upon being dealt with justly, even mercifully.
Sooner or later. But you will be dealt with. Right. Yeah, right. You notice that. Yeah, and we've talked about that before. That, you know, there's infinite mercy, you know, in the infinite sources on paradise. But that's in eternity. And when mercy gets downstepped into time, there's boundaries. There's temporal boundaries to mercy playing out. You know, so we start out with endless grace, basically, in our lives. We can be very, very ignorant, and we don't have to face some absolute judgment, you know, of our lack of perfection. You know, it's just ignorance. You can't help it. No one judges us eternally for that. But that doesn't go on forever. There comes a point where you are judged eternally. There's a simple way to kind of think about it is using that analogy of first miler, second miler. You have a first mile of grace, but there's a threshold line that you cross to the second mile. So, and this is a way of challenging yourself to not use that second miler designation so flippantly, so easily. It's like, oh, I'm a second miler. Think about what the real difference is, what that threshold is. That threshold that you cross from first mile to second mile is a binary threshold. And there comes a point when you have to really choose between eternity and the grace that gets you to that choice. I mean, everyone is eventually led to the point in the universe where you don't need grace anymore. The ignorance is gone. You can now choose, and you have to at that point. You can't go on indefinitely with the ability to choose, finally, without choosing. As soon as you can choose, you have to choose. You know, and it's eternity and oblivion at that binary point. Okay? And when you cross that, when you say yes to eternity and cross into that second mile, then there's a difference. No longer is it kind of like what John was referring to, where, well, today I was pretty good, you know, but yesterday was kind of dicey. You know, is it today I'm peaceful, but yesterday I wasn't so peaceful when you're a second miler? No. What's that particular fruit of the Spirit there? Enduring peace is what a second miler has. There's no variation. It's solid. It's eternity-like. See, they've chosen eternity. And so peace isn't something that just happens occasionally when your temporalness burps the right way. Okay? You don't behave like that anymore. Okay? You have enduring peace. Peace that passes all understanding. It's like, this peace has no temporalness to it. I don't understand how that's possible. Aren't we just human? No. That's what you're crossing. That threshold where you look eternity-like, way in advance of you actually being part of the infinite all are in future eternity. You've brought future eternity into now, and you represent the shadow that it casts. You know? You have enduring peace. Never does it waver ever again. You know? And so, you know, that's a huge challenge to get to that state. You obviously need tons of grace. You need tons of first miler grace to get there. And you have it. Don't try to, you know, just speed up the process. I don't want to be first miler because one is a smaller number than two. I want to be two, okay? It doesn't matter. But let yourself be a one for as long as it takes. Because see, technically, like I said, you get to that threshold, you now can access absolute love, but you're going to access absolute law at the same time. You have to face absolute law. You have to face being in a state from then on without even a nanosecond of variation of being rock solid in some of these foundational elements. It doesn't mean you're perfectly wise, and, you know, you're far from perfection yet, but effectively you're part of eternity now. Okay, at your core. That's the key. Okay.
Yep. I have another one.
Mm-hmm.
Winston said, how does, let's see, it says, Chris, how does the philosophy combined with the revelation help one worry less if our mind is perhaps foolable that worrying or having a fear are not worrying but actually is?
Okay, I mean the base, yeah.
In other words, yeah. We have the capacity to not worry and have a solid rock position of exactness. Is this pattern not a confusion that becomes a wedge that can be avoided?
Okay, so the basic thing there, just how do you make this transition? You have it. You start out as an animal origin creature with, especially pre-six years old, you basically have no innate integrity. You're just a bobbing cork. The whole point is self-mastery. The whole point is that once you're encircled in the Holy Spirit, there's a higher you, initially populated in a minimal way by grace, but there is a higher you that can begin to be a parent to the child, to the animal origin child. And what you're working on is, I mean, that initial personalized self that you're given by grace is one of these rock-solid, unwavering facts. It has to be. I mean, personality is changeless, which means it can only engage something that's changeless. So it can engage some changing thing. So just think about that. What part of you is personal? None of the parts that changes from moment to moment, day to day. That personality can't engage that. It has no relationship with that. So that's different. The only part of you that is personalized is your changeless part. That's your personalized self. So you're given an initial personalized self, a changeless, integrous self by grace. Take a hold of that initial faint flicker of reality and begin to use it to inform the not yet personalized self, the changeable self. And you're slowly working on mastering that. A lot of it is not, you don't want to think of it in building mode. You're not going to build character. You're going to supply the favorable conditions for character to be grown. I mean, the good news is you don't have to have some incredible manual that you follow for arranging your not yet personalized self into the right order so that the personality can engage it. God does that for you. But you have to supply the favorable conditions so God can work through you on lifting that not yet personalized self up. That's what you have control over. So it's allowing yourself to become mastered over time. Being very consecrated to it, but not thinking that you're... you're the source of the construct. You're just the means for it. You're not a creator, you're a procreator. So it's kind of that same mode we were talking about last time. And the more you can just take a hold of, like I said, even though it starts out really, really small as possible, take a hold of that changeless you, that eternalized you. And don't worry about how small it is. look at it from a quality perspective. You couldn't have a higher quality. Forget about thinking of yourself in quantitative terms. Think about yourself in qualitative terms. And over time, if you identify with that quality that's integrous, you'll notice something interesting that happens over time. It's like, wait a minute. When I look back now, I've grown. Yeah, because through that quality, more quantity will be brought up. God will do that part for you. You don't have to think in quantitative terms about, okay, here's a brick and it's got to go this way. And, you know, you don't have to build your character like that. You don't have to handle the quantity part. That's handled for you. You just need to supply the favorable condition of a quality conduit. Be that integrous 6-year-old. Begin as, enter the kingdom of heaven as a child, just like Jesus said. That's what he's talking about. Take a hold of that integrous child. Forget about the not yet integrous child or even the not yet integrous biologic adult. Take a hold of the integrous cosmic child and then let it happen naturally from there. You know, allow yourself to be content to be that starting point. Okay, let's get into the other two branches a little bit here now.
8, legislative and executive functions. On Salvington, the headquarters of Nebadon, there are no true legislative bodies. The universe headquarters worlds are concerned largely with adjudication. The legislative assemblies of the local universe are located on the headquarters of the 100 constellations. The systems are chiefly concerned with the executive and administrative work of the local creations. The system sovereigns and their associates enforce the legislative mandates of the constellation rulers and execute the judicial decrees of the high courts of the universe.
Okay, so in that last little part, you know, you just see the kind of what we understand about the executive branch, you know, that's the way it functions on high. You have, how did they describe it? They, okay, I can find where it said it again. Oh, enforce the legislative mandate. So you have legislative mandates coming down from the constellation, and you have judicial decrees. Yeah, but in either case, there's an executive branch that actually executes those mandates and decrees. Okay, so that's kind of what you'd expect. But it is kind of initially upside down from what you might think. You know, your first thought might be, it's like, well, if I had to put these three branches on the three levels, you probably your first thought would be to stick the executive at the top, you know, and the judicial at the bottom, maybe, you know. But no, there's a lot of authority put into the hands of those executives down on the planetary and local system levels, and they're the least integrous individuals innately. So again, this tells you something about the difference between what your idealism pictures, which is called Havona, and the actual universe of universes that you live in, an evolutionary domain. Then in an evolutionary domain, those with the least perspective in many ways are the spear points. This is an important thing to reflect upon, because the more spiritual humans have become, the more we're able to consciousize ideals, the more we're beginning to grind to a halt in terms of executing a civilization. Because the more you consciousness of ideals you have, the more you go, well, I don't want to act yet because, you know, what about this and what about that? And that could happen and this could happen. And I need to work on, we should have more meetings on arranging this some more. You know, you get into this mode where you never act because you're so trying to Havonaize the playing board, you know, the game board, before you act. That's the fifth epical revelation says, no, that's a false idea. The true idea, if you want to make yourself true with the cosmos, you need people that just act. I mean, they tell you that they've tried to build this into the system by making us religious, kind of just by nature. You know, we're given a religious impulse, just as a sixth adjutant, a clueless impulse that just drives us, okay? It's a pure energy. You know, religionists may not always act wisely, but they act. See, this is the thing. Well, we've become less and less religious as a people. I mean, it's more and more secularized, and we're getting more and more wrapped around the axle with our spiritual consciousness, you know, trying to somehow get it idealistic before we act. And, okay, no, that's false. All that's false, they're trying to tell you. So ironically, the people that a very idealistic, very spiritually conscious person would reject as a leader, the revelation is saying, no, that's the person that should be the leader. The one that doesn't try to dot every I and cross every T first. He just goes, well, looks like this. Then he just acts. That's, and then you guide it from there. But someone has to get it moving first. An ignorant Lenonendek gets it moving. And then the system guides it from there. You know, but he doesn't overthink it. He just, I mean, this is, you know, it'd be nice to see if Lucifer, you know, had thought about it a little bit more before he acted. But see, he's not designed that way. He's designed to just act. And he did. And then later on, after he'd acted, he's like, well, wait, now that I think about it, that was clueless, wasn't it?
He didn't do that.
No, he did. I mean, at a certain point, and they tell you, I mean, he starts out, it's just evil. He's just ignorant. He's just acted. He thought it was good. But, you know, he has the Holy Spirit. Eventually, as he gets into the ways and starts to reflect on it, goes, oh, wait a minute, crap. No, that isn't right, is it? But he'd already gone public. And he was a coward. So at that point, he started choosing that which he knew to be bad. It went from evil to sin. But it didn't start as sin. It started as just as evil and ignorance.
Yeah. Well, he must act, but what he's charged to do is to enforce the legislative mandates,
yes,
of the constellation rulers and execute the judicial decrees of the high courts. He's not called to...
Right.
Usurp those.
Of course. Yeah, you know that's what Lucifer did. You know, he immediately, you know, yeah, set up his own, you know, tribunals and all this sort of stuff. You know, but, right.
He's not to make up the laws. I mean, this should be telling us how our executive should approach
his duty. Of course. Which is happening less and less that way, the more, like I was saying, because we're slipping out of the mode. You know, we're getting more and more of this mode. It's like, well, you know, it's inconvenient to deal with that other body. You know, it'd be so much more efficient if I could just, you know, be all three branches. And yes, see, that there's a place for that. In a much more primitive civilization, you need it all concentrated in a king because of its efficiency. I mean, it's too primitive a circumstance to try to somehow democratize it. Nothing will ever get done. I mean, that's part of the American experiment. Are we evolved enough now that we can democratize this a little bit and still go somewhere? Or is it all just going to grind to a halt when you don't have a king just driving the spear point forward through the mess? Okay. But yeah, see, there's all these lessons. See, and these are philosophic lessons. They're not religious lessons. This isn't having to do with my salvation or anything like that. And this is the real meat of the fifth epical revelation. Being a religious person who acts, but then looking up to the cosmos for what you're supposed to be acting on. What are the legislative mandates and judicial decrees, quote unquote, of the cosmos? What should I be acting on as an activated religious individual? You know, and unfortunately we have activated religious individuals, but they don't look to the cosmos for, you know. They look to themselves, or they look to some arbitrary authority, you know, or whatnot. So again, that's a part of the lesson they're trying to teach us. What are you supposed to be doing once you've activated yourself like Jesus told you to do? Told you to be you know, take hold of the spiritual uplift and be spiritual. Okay, now you put yourself in cooperative subordination to the whole. You know, step one, activate self. Step two, put self underneath the whole. Okay, we have an emergency because we did step one but not step two. Led to a whole emergency revelation that's sitting in my lap. The failure to do step two. The failure to be humble if you're going to be spiritual. all right, so now just a little bit more back to the immediacy here of this paragraph. There are no true legislative bodies. Did you notice that they use? That's kind of an interesting, you know. And they're going to explain that a little bit. There are, there is legislative elements outside of the constellation level. It's not all at the constellation level. But they're saying that those things that are outside are not quote-unquote true legislative bodies. I said this in passing, you know, back at the beginning of the evening here, that they're trying to tell you that there's a not immediately recognizable cosmic harmony to this separation into three branches that makes it true. You know, to be true is to conform with the cosmos. And that's what they're getting at. But they're pointing out that it's not trivial. You don't get this conformity to the cosmos by putting everything legislative at one level and everything judicial, you know, et cetera. Like we've already mentioned, there's tribunals, you know, high and low throughout the whole system. It isn't all just on Salvington, okay? But what's on Salvington has to be on Salvington, and what's on Edentia, in our case, has to be on Edentia, and what's on Gerasim has to be on Gerasim. Because if those key foundational elements aren't totally separated, and not, then somehow the whole system is not true. So they don't explain it. They just toss that out and let you try to figure out what that means. Again, to seek after that statement. So they don't, you know, they didn't say genuine, say. They said true legislative bodies. That's a much stronger statement. There are, you know, they're about to describe, there's genuine legislative, you know, functions going on, say, on Salvington. But it's not this true part, this actual mysterious harmony thing that makes it cosmic. Okay, just want to point that out because I can't explain what that means, but I see it's there. So it's a goal to strive for, to try to figure out what that is talking about. Anything else there? When they say the system sovereign and their associates, that includes the planetary princes. Now, that executive thing is distributed down to the individual worlds too. So it isn't all just at the executive stuff is not all just at the system, local system capital level. You know, it's spread throughout the local system, as it were. All right.
While true legislation is not enacted at the universe headquarters, there do function on Salvington a variety of advisory and research assemblies, variously constituted and conducted in accordance with their scope and purpose. Some are permanent. Others disband upon the accomplishment of their objective.
So, see, we don't get any specifics, but we get these general statements, you know, telling you that, you don't want to think of, if you try to match this on down here, don't try to make them all permanent. Make some of them, you know, ad hoc. And see, they're giving you these little clues like this, just all over in here. A variety of advisory and research assemblies. She knows that? Again, reminding you that in all areas, including this, there is ignorance in the universe of universes. You have to discover everything, including the higher beings. They have to have research assemblies. And they go out and research and discover the proper legislation, the proper judicial action. It's an experiential domain. It's not existential. You know? So this knowledge doesn't just exist and gets imposed. They go out exploring and discover, and you're about to see how that kind of gets fed into the system then. But, you know, literally thinking of yourself in a scientific mode about, you know, the judiciary, say, you know, and just making a knowledge discovery, a scientific discovery in that area and feeding that into the system.
Well, I was just in section 4, periodically the authors express something that Jesus said, and you can tell that they are marveling because this has never been expressed in the local universe before.
Right.
This is brand new.
They made a discovery. Yeah.
Yes, and this is a human expressing this truth.
Right. And that's why, you know, they're listening to everyone's thoughts all the time, you know, because every once in a while, you know, even a lowly mortal, doesn't have to be a Jesus-like phenomenon, you know, just a run-of-the-mill mortal, makes a discovery. You know, we all have the potential to discover part of experiential reality. You know, initially, obviously, we're only going to discover small pieces, but we can discover, and they will note that discovery and feed that into the system so that everyone can benefit from that discovery, you know, that Nick made yesterday, say. You know, the ancients of days will make use of that a million years from now or whatever. It gets fed into the system, and it's circulating throughout the information network. And so that's an important element. Let's see, what else? I was going to say something else there. But anyway, I can't remember now what it was. But just, you know, stressing that research element, that's...
Here we have true legislation
here. Yeah, and you see the true legislation. Yeah, see, obviously, that's why I've stressed it, because they repeat it. So it's obviously something they want you to try to figure out. You know, we just... I know what it was. This bit about the research. Think of an example of how that spirit, the spirit of that fact, got infused into the founding of the United States. When the founders spoke of it as an experiment. Recognizing that having a federal system where you had states would really help with this research element that would make it true, that the states are supposed to be the laboratories where you're researching. You're trying this out, see if it works. You're not imposing it upon the whole nation by fiat because you think you're innately divine, you know, and you should just, you know, impose it imperially on the whole nation. You break it up into states. And that spirit, see, is... was recognized. It's amazing when you start to think about these insights that are inherent in the founding of the United States, how much of it is obviously not coincidental. It's tapping in to the higher truths, the higher picture, and getting an initial sense of expressing that. We need to be researching and discovering better judicial forms and better legislative forms. And, you know, we can't impose it on everyone uniformly. Or you short-circuit that. Okay? See, so that's another thing that we got to get back to that. We've been drifting away from that because we find it messy and inconvenient, that, you know, to herd of cats-like. It's like, no, it's important. Even at the highest levels of the local universe, they're out there researching and making new discoveries. You know, if it was clamped down, it wouldn't be happening. You short-circuit evolution. You got to let the process be evolutionary. Don't try to make it Havona by fiat, because you'll get the opposite. You'll get anti-Havona by is all you'll get by fiat.
Yeah, that act part.
Yeah.
The act is ours, consequence of God. That should set the act free, that concept.
Yeah, I mean, you just got to let the whole play out. And the whole plays out subtly in the part. And it plays out over long spans of time. That's just the way it is. The goodness is in that subtlety and in that long temporal span. We can't demand a 100-year life filled with definitive Havona-like manifestations. You know, or we won't be satisfied. We have to get out of that mode. We've got to let it be basically imperceptible in the span of our lifetime and in the short range of vision of our eyes. We got to trust. You know, live predicated on that which you can't see. It's not that you don't see. You literally can't see what you have to live your life by. You're not capable of seeing it yet. It can't be done with sight. It has to be done with faith. It's designed that way. Faith and trust. They've purposely made it so that the only way you can go forward is by taking a hold of that which can't be seen. And if anything, you know, we should be relishing in that. We're agonauters. Okay, that's the whole point. We have this great opportunity to trust more than anyone, than most people have the opportunity to trust. Because there's a bunch of things that normally people could see. And we can't see any of those things. We can't see Adam and Eve. We can't see a planetary headquarters. We can't see any of these things. You know, so we have the opportunity to trust more than anyone will ever have the opportunity to trust in the universe. It's a precious opportunity to trust whole scale.
Could you say a little bit about if that is the objective reality that is the supreme, that is always advancing, that we're striving to strike step with?
Mm-hmm.
Did I say that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's the whole point. I mean, we live in an evolutionary domain, encompassed by an evolutionary God. You're trying to strike step with that. You're not trying to strike step with the existential Father. You're trying to strike step with an evolving God. Yeah. And throughout all of human history, humans have been trying to strike step with an existential Father. And have not had much success because it's impossible. This is really good news that you don't have to try to somehow be perfect tomorrow and strike step with the existential Father. You don't have to be perfect. You need to be perfecting. To be perfecting is to strike step with the Supreme, the evolving Supreme. That's what you're supposed to do. All right. Where did we get? I guess we just read those first two, didn't we? Yeah. Okay, go ahead.
The Supreme Council of the local universe is made up of 3 members from each system and 7 representatives from each constellation. Systems in isolation do not have representation in this assembly, but they are permitted to send observers who attend and study all its deliberations. The 100 councils of supreme sanction are also situated on Salvington. Presidents of these councils constitute the immediate working cabinet of Gabriel.
Not a lot of information there, but they are at least trying to give you a couple examples of this variety of advisory and research assemblies. So here's a couple of ones that are permanent. Yeah, we don't have any examples of the ad hoc ones, but so here's a couple examples of permanent ones. And, you know, they've come up with interesting names like Councils of Supreme Sanction. But you notice, okay, now here's Gabriel again. So we started out, when we first were introduced to Gabriel, he was called a chief executive. And then the previous section, it said that the entire judicial mechanism of Nebadon is under the supervision of Gabriel. And then here you have this legislative-like body that's the working cabinet of Gabriel. Okay, so, like I was saying, it's not like, you know, you literally have the executive, legislative, and judicial separated and isolated on these three levels. It's a cosmic system. A true cosmic system has all three facets at every point in it. Okay? It has individuality, associativity, and unity at every point. It's just, you know, whether or not a particular facet is, you know, leading. It's the facing facet or whatever you want to say. Okay, in a particular circumstance. And, you know, we already, like, really recognized that because Gabriel is fundamentally a Salvington being, you know, not a constellation being or a local system being, he really is rooted at the top. He is going to be a unity, a judicial mode sort of being. Not an individuality or an associativity sort of thing. So when he does executive or legislative-related things, it's in that judicial mode. It's in that more unity-like mode. You notice I'm kind of tracking back, giving you a little bit of clue. I told you about reflecting upon judicial, legislative, executive, and the distinction. Remember how they're laid out. Executive is at the individuality level, legislative is at the associativity level, judicial is at the unity level. That's going to be the fundamental philosophic difference of how you approach things. Are you in a unity mode, an associativity mode, or an individuality mode? And to be a true executive, you should be in an individuality mode. To be a true, you know, magistrate, I guess you might say, you know, you should be in the unity mode. To be a true legislator, you should be in associativity mode. That's what is being taught to us here. Okay? And so, and even if you, because you want to be cosmic, and so you're not going to just be specialized to just one facet, you're going to involve all three, you have to have a sense of, in order to be a true unity functioning phenomenon, if that's your role, you have to have a relationship with associativity and individuality as well. You can't be hyper-specialized, over-specialized, technically, see? So that would, we're looking for cosmic citizens to have a more advancing governmental form. They need to have relationship with all three: individuality, associativity, unity, science, philosophy, religion. But then they're going to put a particular facet forward. Because, you know, if nothing else, there's a limit to how much any one of us little lowly humans can do. We can't do everything. So we've got to pick something. It's likely to be highly specialized and circumscribed to a degree. But can you bring a cosmic character into being a legislator? So you're going to basically be working on the associativity phenomenon, but you do it in the context of being very aware of unity and individuality as well. No, you aren't hyper-specialized. That's what they're trying to get at.
It's a good insight into how legislative has to work and how it can't be true. It can't be true because it's associative and it has to evolve. Mm-hmm. It can't just be true.
Right. So all these things, so you just know, this is what the fifth epical revelation is the kind of mind activity that it's trying to, you know, get us going on. you know, not just spiritual thoughts, you know, and attempting to convince yourself that you're saved. Okay. It's, you know, it's much more than that. If you're going to dedicate your life to being a religionist, you want to be a true religionist. This means you have to have within you a cosmic understanding of the associativity and individuality domains as well. You have to know about facts, for instance, the individuality domain. You know, most religionists are not true religionists because they're just clueless about facts. You know, a lot of them don't even think they need to even, you know, have to even consider facts. You know, maybe because they're evil, you know, or whatever, you know, they've decided. You know, it's all just about the unity, and that's all you need. Yeah. So, all right. Let's see. Anything else there? You noticed a little thing about we only have observers on that Supreme Council. Which is an interesting thing. Okay, so, well, that's because of the rebellion. Say, well, but it's interesting that even when you have an expression of what happens because of rebellion, it's curiously similar to what always happens, even without rebellion. Does the local universe have an official seat on the councils at the super universe level? No, because we're not settled in light and life. Mm-hmm. See, so from a high perspective, they don't treat you any different. Rebellion or not rebellion, you still don't have a seat because you're not worthy yet. So really the difference between rebellion and not is a difference of no concern. So that's kind of an interesting thing to notice, you know, that if you remember when we read that sentence sounded an awful lot like what they said when we were talking about the super universe level of these sorts of things. Okay? Had nothing to do with rebellion there. So again, remind yourself that rebellion, don't treat that as this intensely negative alternative reality that's been imposed upon us. It's natural. It's part of the system. It's especially natural in a mercy-dominated local universe. It's not, you know, Michael, needs rebellion in order to make the universe he's trying to make. He can't make his kind of local universe without rebellion. So he's not going to stop them before they start. They're indispensable to his flavor of local universe. So yeah, you can be hard on Lucifer, but
serving a purpose.
It's part of a bigger whole. It's hard to see the goodness of the truth of when you're immersed down in the depths of the consequences of what Lucifer did.
From inside the rebellion.
And from inside, it's very hard to be objective about it. Right. But
that's a lot of supreme adjusters, too.
Yeah. Right. All right.
All findings of the High Universe Advisory Councils are referred either to the Salvington judicial bodies or to the legislative assemblies of the constellations. These high councils are without authority or power to enforce their recommendations. If their advice is founded on the fundamental laws of the universe, then will the Nebadon courts issue rulings of execution. But if their recommendations have to do with local or emergency conditions, they must pass down to the legislative assemblies of the constellation for a deliberative enactment and then to the system authorities for execution. These high councils are, in reality, the universe super-legislatures, but they function without the authority of enactment and without the power of execution.
So that's kind of, you know, you can see that, you know, it's a big paragraph there. They wanted to talk about that a little bit to inspire us to think about the potentials of how humans could work such things in, you know, where you have a body that is really kind of more in this research mode. Like I was saying, you know, that's kind of, you know, we sort of set that, you know, a state could be in a research mode. If it makes a real significant discovery about a really efficient way to work a particular part of the system, they can pass that information, say, up to the national level. You know, and maybe it will get enacted in some more universal way. But it will be an experiential discovery of it being true, found locally, before it was imposed in a more global fashion. And so you see how you have this on high, you know, and very precise about, you know, if it has to do with the fundamental laws of the universe, you know, then it feeds into the Nebadon courts. But if it's local or emergency issues, then it feeds into that legislative assembly. And you notice, you know, deliberative enactment. And we hear that, oh boy, yeah, the gobbledygook mess of throwing it to the House of Representatives, say, you know, and having it churn in that massive pile of people with coming at things from every which direction. It's so messy. But see, you know, they're pointing out, no, it needs to experientialize. It needs to be, you know, brought into as much relationship with all of the subtleties that are in that evolutionary system. You know, because it's not just what you immediately see there. It looks like a room full of cats, the House of Representatives. But there's something there that's very profound that you can't see. The subtle harmony of the Supreme. The presence of the Supreme is there in the midst of what seems to be chaos. There's a cosmos there that you have to trust and just let itself work out. Don't try to, you know, improve upon the Supreme by going around that messy process. Trust, let it play out. Okay? All right.
While we speak of universe administration in terms of courts and assemblies, it should be understood that these spiritual transactions are very different from the more primitive and material activities of Urantia, which bear corresponding names, presented by the chief of the archangels of Nebadon.
Now, just, is it not curious that that's the final paragraph? So when all is said and done, they decided to throw that curious little paragraph in on the end. Okay, now it's an important reminder. We do it a lot, you know. I mean, you need to upgrade your definition of every word, basically, that you know, in order to really engage the revelation. So that's there. But it also is an encouragement of what I've said a number of times tonight. Don't judge what you see in front of you right now in the world existentially. See it in a new way. See it as part of experiential deity, not existential deity. So don't worry about what it isn't. Discover what it is and work on engaging that and moving that forward. Try not to let your spiritual consciousness dominate your perception so that all you have is this intense error and evil detector, imperfection and detector, you know, of your spiritual consciousness, where all it'll see is what everything isn't. Well, that isn't that, and that isn't that, and that's all it'll ever see. Try to get a cosmic perspective on things. Notice there must be a thread of truth in the word court, and a thread of truth in the word assembly, despite their factual, you know, inadequacies. If there wasn't a thread of truth, they wouldn't have used them in here, and they wouldn't have had to have had that footnote. Yeah. So that's the other thing. They're encouraging you to judge things truthfully, not factually. Okay, because it's a revelation of truth. So if they use the word court, there's truth in the word court. Find the truth in the word court. Don't just judge it for what a court isn't. Yeah. The irony that your idealistic consciousness, your spiritual consciousness, your unity consciousness, doesn't function in a spiritual mode most of the time. It functions in a material mode, deals with material facts, and passes these judgments on them. You know, and so it gets in that very existential mode about material facts. All right. Then the last little thing is just that the byline. Presented by the chief of archangels is Nebadon. You don't see it here, but we'll see it in a couple at the end of the two papers from now, when it says that paper is sponsored by the chief of archangels, acting by authority of Gabriel of Salvington. So on that paper, paper 35, they give you a little bit more, tell you that the chief of archangels here is actually one of the 12, the local universe revelatory commission, one of those 12 is the chief of archangels. So he wasn't just, assigned this task by the committee. He's one of the 12 on the committee. And that's what you know that when they actually, indicate that the author is acting on the authority of Gabriel, that means he's one of the commission. Because everyone else is acting on the authority of the commission. It's a commission that's acting on the authority of Gabriel. See, so it tells you in that indirectly if the person is actually on the commission. And as the chief of archangels, a very high spirit being, he would have had to have used the contact personality. He couldn't have dictated this directly to the secondary midware. So this is a paper that required the contact personality to get it into midware hands. Yeah, so even a little byline, there's all kinds of fun things there. like I said, we want to kind of notice that in passing as we go through, because it's much more complicated than it was in part one. You've got some of them that are on the commission and a lot of them that aren't. They've been brought in by the commission to do a particular paper. All right, well, so next time, we've got the last of these initial three papers on the local universes. We've got to flesh out the big thing that we've only touched on, the other half of the supervision of a local universe, the creative mother spirit. So we'll get into the mom next time. All right, let's take a moment here.